You may be seated. Hey, wonderful to have you here this morning. And, you know, you're in for a special treat. I told you at the very beginning of this series that this was going to be a very different kind of sermon series, something that I've been prompted over the last number of years in talking to you about something that's been on my heart, this abundant life that Jesus talked about. And I said I would initiate the five areas that we're going to look at, and then we're going to bring an expert, somebody with experience about what we're talking about, as part of the second part two of each of these topics. And last week we talked about the mind, we talked about thoughtfulness, we talked about, you know, the world of intellectual pursuit as it related to the gospel, as related to the truth of the Bible. Because for many of us, to be a Christian in the culture that we live in is seen to be not a very intelligent thing to do. And for many of us, when we're caught in social circumstances or some situations, we're afraid to even admit we're a Christian. And when we get into the academic world, there's a level of hostility there that is unbelievable. And you know, before I introduce our special guest this morning, and as part of the interview that we're going to do today and talk about the academic world, I have a quote that I want to just let you I just want to read, and it actually comes from Darwin. So here's the quote from Darwin. There it is. Thanks, Kaylee. This is an amazing quote. If I had my life to live over again, I would have made it a rule to read some poetry and listen to some music at least once a week. For perhaps the part of my mind, now atrophied, would have thus been kept active through use. The loss of these tastes is a loss of happiness and may possibly be injurious to the intellect, and more probably to the moral character, by enfeebling the emotional part of our nature. That came from Darwin. Wow, isn't that an amazing quote? I just love that. But you know what? We've talked about mindfulness. We've talked about thoughtfulness, the academic world. Next week, we're going to look at the emotional component of all of this. Really important to be a part of it. But it's my privilege this morning to introduce, and maybe not introduce totally to many of you, but Dr. Carolyn Weber. Carolyn, if you would come up and join us this morning. Now, the next slide, I'm going to do a bit of a promo for you. Now, you have books and everything. Now, yeah.
That's on, so I have to be nice.
You have to be nice, you know, but welcome. Thank you very much for doing this, okay?
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Our pleasure, our privilege to have you. Now, I have to say this, and you're going to, don't be upset with me, but here are a number of things that is part of your resume.
That's so cool. I've always wondered what you were looking at up there.
You thought I was just heavenly minded, right? And just kind of looking up all the time.
Gabriel or something.
Yeah. But I need to tell everybody, that's an impressive list of accomplishment, but that is absolutely a fraction of what your resume looks like. Just a very small fraction. I know I'm embarrassing you and all of that stuff. I was going to, I got...
Sound like my mother.
I think I got to slide 8, and I thought, or starting slide 9, and I thought, no, I better stop. I'll just leave it at 1.
Oh my goodness,
yeah.
You really sound like my mother.
Yeah, okay. But I'm very thankful that you're here this morning to talk about this subject, because you've been involved in the academic world, you've grown up in the academic world, and you became a believer. Mm-hmm. While pursuing academics. So I thought it'd be really important for people to hear about your experience and what we can take away from this whole intellectual pursuit. Because for many of us, spirituality is nothing more than just the way we feel about God and the way we feel about, because it's very experiential kind of world that we live in, and we don't think that it's an intellectual pursuit in any way, shape, or form. So can you tell us a little bit about your desire to pursue academia and how this all began for you?
Well, first of all, I just have to thank you again, John, for inviting me, because it's such a privilege to be here and such a pleasure. And I hope I don't cry, because it's also just a sheer joy. You know, I grew up just in the neighborhood down the street from this church, and some of you might know that I grew up in an unbelieving family, and I used to bicycle to this church when it was the Westmont Library to hide out and read, particularly from my father at the time, who was in and out of our lives and quite tumultuous when he showed up. So I had no idea that there was a church upstairs. I had no idea about God and that sort of thing. And so I just find it an immense circle of grace to sit here now among all of you in my church family and be able to talk about these ideas and welcome them. I think I got drawn into academia because I enjoyed quite literally just the pursuit of knowledge. I enjoyed reading. I found that reading for me as a child not only opened a world of exploration and imagination, but also of escape in some ways too. And the more I studied, the more I got drawn into it. I think after teaching undergraduates for years and years, freshmen that sit in an opening class of literature and they look at me with their baseball caps on backwards and ask me how it's relevant to read poetry. I thought the Darwin quote was really interesting. It's just how, it's like Philip Sidney said in the Renaissance that literature in many ways is the architectonicity of everything. And what he meant by that is, you know, you can be a lawyer, but not be a poet, obviously, usually, or study medicine and not write stories. But when you write a story or write a poem, you can write about all of those things. So it encompasses all of those things. So in a sense, reading them introduces you to all of those worlds. And I just loved reading, and I loved that poetry, for example. I think what Darwin is getting at is it's not intimidating if we think about it as an extension of our rhythmic beings, that we're made to be these rhythmic beings. There's a heartbeat that's happening in the things that are most essential to us. There's a rhythm in our speech, a rhythm in our breathing, a rhythm in our blood circulation, a rhythm in music, in walking, in everything that we do. And that rhythm comes out in poetry, but it also comes out in, I think, also a very basic desire to make sense out of chaos, which is also in the image of God. And so I was drawn to all of that way before I was ever a believer. And that's why I loved it and studied it.
Wow. And you just released a book of poetry yourself,
didn't you?
Okay.
Yes, I did.
Cool. Cool. I was going to quote one of the, and I absolutely forgot it. I had a stanza quoted, but anyway.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, your book, Surprised by Oxford, which probably many of us have some familiarity with, isn't essentially your conversion story, but it's part of it. Tell us a little bit about that journey and how the gospel appealed to you intellectually.
Mm. Well, as I had mentioned, I grew up in essentially an unbelieving family, what I would have described as loosely Catholic, perhaps. You know, we go to church a couple times a year, more so when I was younger. My grandparents were Hungarian immigrants, and so we would go to Mass. And when you're young, Mass in Hungarian and Latin doesn't really hold your attention.
No?
So I really didn't know what was going on. It was over my head. And then slowly, as that family circle began to die away and whatnot, you know, I just didn't really go to church that much. My parents ended up, after 27 years of marriage, getting a divorce, and it was a problematic scenario. As I mentioned, my father was in and out of my life. And so in many ways, I wasn't going to trust in an eternal father when I really couldn't trust in an earthly one. And so I invested more and more in my studies, partly out of that passion and also partly out of self-sufficiency. And I ended up, I studied here at Huron College, my undergraduate here at Huron College, and then I left Huron College at University of Western Ontario to study at Oxford University on a Commonwealth scholarship. And by the time I left, I had sort of been the frog in the pot that boiled. You know, at that point I was quite cynical, quite self-sufficient. I mean, happy in many ways, how we would define ourselves as that culturally, engaged to a wonderful man who was very atheistic and clear on that. And I had this longing in me, I think we all do, I haven't ever met anyone who doesn't, but I think it really defines what we are as human. But I certainly didn't have any kind of faith or any sort of trust in a God, and would have defined myself as even perhaps feminist and sort of not so far as atheist, because I couldn't disprove God, but definitely agnostic. And so that's where I was putting all my eggs, in that basket, going to hell basket, but a definitely kind of, which I think is a basket in many ways that academia nurtures, because as I entered more and more into the academic world, like any of our worlds, it's so easy to judge each other in our various ways. But I think particularly with academia, one of the reasons why it has such a resistance towards faith is because it deems itself so self-sufficient. I remember when I first entered into an English department as a newbie, as a very young professor, and wondering why all the professors were arguing with each other in my department, when I just got along with everybody. I was also the Canadian, right, in the American department. Let's go for a Tim's. I'm like, a what? I remember a friend of mine saying to me, because the turf is so important, but it's intellectual turf, people really vest themselves in their ideas, and they really get their knickers in a knot over their ideas, because that's really who they are. As I grew more and more in academia, I realized that particularly there is this self-sufficiency. It's very much a place that that is judged by merit, by what you do. I mean, we struggle with that all the time. I was just reading Galatians again this morning, and chapter 2, and really that emphasis on how we are justified by faith, not by what we do, and the freedom of that. But that is completely antithetical to something like the academic environment. We see that even with children in school, right, with how they're graded and expectancies and things along those lines. And some of that can be healthy to a degree, obviously, but there's also this sense in which grace is a very alien concept. And so is love. And we know that love, with anything done without love, is a clanging cymbal. And academia particularly, I think there's a reason why Jesus had a lot of issues with the Pharisees and the learned people of his time.
Yeah, there's a word you've used a couple of times, and I know even, and I've experienced in the academic world, even in the biblical academic world, the word cynicism.
Yes.
Academia seems to promote over time this level of cynicism to everything around it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I think is very vogue too, in a sense of, you know, deconstruction and all that sort of thing. Can you really know anything? Which I think is really ironic when it claims to be a pursuit of truth. But I think what rattled my world when I finally first heard the gospel really clearly from a friend of mine, I eventually married, but that's another interview.
TDH.
Tall, dark, and handsome. Now he's TBH. He's tall, bald, and handsome. Still handsome. Still handsome. you can hear the gospel in various ways, or we can always think that we hear the gospel in the media, but the media certainly doesn't portray the gospel, and the world doesn't always portray it. And sometimes it really takes someone saying it clearly, with respect, and not condescension, and also with kindness and love and humility, where it conveys itself to you, and you begin to also, when you see people living that faith authentically, it carries a reality that is hard to ignore. And when I began to meet other Christians who were living that way, when I started to read the Bible, I mean, to go back to your question, John, of how did, you know, being an academic lead into even, you know, your awareness of faith. When I first read the Bible, and it's shocking to me that you can go through 15, 20 years of public school education and not read the Bible in North America, not be required to read the Bible. which, separate from religious affiliation or whatnot, I think is incredibly shocking when really most of literature up until the 20th century, in Western tradition in particular, is in response to the Bible, and anything postmodernist is still in response to the Bible.
Yeah.
You still need to know it. And I had never been required, and I finally sat down and read it cover to cover because I love books and Christians are the original bibliophiles. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked at how much it made sense. I remember even Genesis, just beginning with Genesis, and I thought, wait a minute. Actually, the fallen world, our fallen condition, and what we long for, and what I know I long for somewhere in me that I can't put into words, that Sehnsucht that C.S. Lewis identified as that infinite longing, the German term for it, is rooted in the story of Genesis. And I remember feeling immense sadness the first time I read about when Adam and Eve had sinned and been disobedient, and God's walking in the garden and looking for them, and they're hiding from him. And that sadness, that immense sadness of that loss. And all then the theological interpretations of Genesis, which I found so fascinating, that are we perhaps still in Eden, we just don't see it anymore. Is the snake within ourselves. You know, all those ways that we can interpret those things. But I found in the Bible not only a common sense practicality of, wow, the fallen world actually is makes sense to me. And then I had this quandary because I had all pressures from the outside academic world telling me that the Bible was nonsense. But I was finding as I was reading it more and more, not only did it make a common sense thread, but it was so incredibly intricate. I could never in a million years have put it together. And everything tied into everything all the way through to Revelation. And there was also this purpose and this hope in it. It made to me, not only intellectual sense, and it was a cohesive belief system, but it also made sense deeper than I could put words to. And I remember, for example, even reading when Jesus says to forgive someone, you know, 70 times 7. And I thought, oh my goodness, like I could ever do that. But I remember literally thinking about that as I was going into a VIVA, which is an oral examination at Oxford, with my Sanhedrin in front of me. And the Sanhedrin court, the great Sanhedrin, is 71 people, consists of 71 men, 70 of which can vote. And I thought, and they were the ones that judged Jesus the most harshly when they should have known the prophecy. And I thought, wow. He's saying we need to forgive these people every day of the week, each one of them. Yeah. And when I began to see that there was just so many resonances to every single verse in the Bible, it could never be plumbed fully, and yet it was there for everyone in any need, at any time, for everybody. I was absolutely blown away by how the Lord comes to us as a book and as a baby. And I began to grapple with those tensions in a world, particularly a system that not only doesn't understand that or seek it, but also puts it down.
Well, you know, I personally really resonate with that, because I remember that same crisis where, yeah, I started reading the Bible and I'm going, wait a minute, this absolutely makes sense. Mm-hmm. This is, mm-hmm, so much part of what I'm seeing and experiencing. So when I read that part, mm-hmm, in your book, I think I actually jumped up and said, yeah, somebody else gets this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, in light of that, have you personally experienced any prejudice in the world? Because, you know, you wear your faith pretty.
This
pretty
is where openly. We bring the bottle of wine out, because we're not Catholic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, just one?
Oh yeah, Greek and Hungarian.
Yeah,
you know.
We had a whole
first miracle.
First miracle.
Oh, I love that question, because I thought, oh my goodness. Oh, where do I start? I prayed over it, and I thought, okay, because you're my hometown folk, so I love you guys extra special. But I thought I would share a story, because I have many, including, I remember even when I was first even thinking about becoming a Christian, not even a Christian yet, and talking with a thesis supervisor at the time, who said to me it would be absolute career suicide if you became a Christian. You know, if you wanted to become a professor as well. Those kind of things that have happened along the way, and sort of the subtle persecutions that happen. And this is by no means to compare it with the greater persecutions that happen worldwide. But the persecutions that we face as Christians in subtle ways in our society that also push us to the margins. And one of those, you know, for instance, is many colleagues I've also worked with as well who have a faith, and if you share it more openly, some are really called to love their students, and they do that kind of under the radar, and I really admire how they navigate that way. Others who maybe perhaps are more outspoken, and particularly in secular campuses, are then told, like I was, you know, not to proselytize to your students or not to publish on your faith because that won't count towards your platform, your career platform. And so you're then required to do three times the work, you know, to keep the position, those kind of things. And they have financial and economic realities in that as well. And so what I found with one example I can give you was when my husband and I first moved home from the States a few years ago, we came back initially to do some writing and to love on my unbelieving family up close here, and I was approached by my alma mater, and they were looking for a professor position. I happened to be right in my area, and a former professor had told me that they were advertising, and my alma mater had a very small department. And I had just had a baby. I wasn't sure about going back yet, but I remember thinking, you know, this could be, and I praying over it and thinking maybe this is a really important opportunity to go back and start teaching students here too. And I went in for the interview process, which is a pretty intense process. And when I went into the interview part with the department, just the department, I was also really grateful for the opportunity because these were the professors I had known and who had so shaped me before I became a Christian. A couple had known I had become a Christian. I had shared with them my conversion later on after I became a Christian at Oxford, here and there. But the amazing opportunity to sit in a room with 10, 12 other people that I had known before I was a Christian, who were not Christians themselves, didn't share that faith, and who had shaped me greatly. I had had most of them as professors and loved them dearly because they had given me this love of literature. A handful of them I know to be very, very cynical and even very anti-Christian from years and years ago. But so delighted to be there. I mean, what an opportunity that is. And I remember making up my resume at the time for the job application and thinking, should I leave the Christian books off? Because this is a secular environment, and should I just go forward? And Kent said to me, he said, if you take the Christian writing off in any connotation that you're a Christian, you'll get the job. I'm a Kent. Mm. He's so big. It's like you and my mom. But he said, but is that who you are? And oh, part of me wanted to not play the Christian card because I knew that it would unravel everything and I wanted those students so badly and I wanted to go back to my alma mater and I thought, wow, we could really set roots here and we could afford a second car. One that doesn't break down. But I remember going in and sitting with all of them at the table, the Sanhedrin in so many metaphorical ways. And the very first question out of the very first professor's mouth was a question out of my postmodernist professor's mouth, who had always been antagonistic towards the faith, who had very much preached that he was an atheist from the classroom and continued to do so even 25 years later. And his very first question to me was, I've looked at your accomplishments and I've seen what you've done and I've heard of what's happened to you. You're a very different person now than you were when I had you. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, how can you believe in something so narrow? Very first question out of his mouth. And I remember the tears burning in the back of my throat at first because I love these people too. I wanted to say to him, you've given me so much. You opened the door to me for for the Aeneid and the Odyssey, and you told me to read the great works, and look, I went ahead and did, and oops, I read the greatest work. And I did tell him that later in the interview, but I felt the tears, and I also felt this rage come up. The old knee-jerk reaction of wanting to say to him, how dare you? because he had gone on to say, how do I know you won't proselytize, you know, from the podium, from your class podium to your students? How can I trust you to teach the Bible? By the way, he teaches the Bible and literature. And won't you be biased? And he went on with this tirade. And I wanted so badly to say to him, first of all, my very political, academic position of years of experience at this point in committees and things, we know how committees are, I wanted to say to him, wow, you could be sued for what you're just asking me. You've just hired a chair in Islamic studies, and I bet you didn't ask her these questions. I wanted to play that hand so badly. And I don't know if it was the hand of God or the fact that I was still nursing a baby and I was hormonally, emotional, or the Holy Spirit, although I'm sure it was a combination of all, maybe they're not separate. I took a breath and I said to him, I understand exactly where you're coming from because I've been there too. And this is what I believe and why. And I appreciate you preparing my heart to understand that love. And the whole room went quiet. And then there was a barrage of other questions. And it ended up being an interview of basically 30, 40 minutes of just questions against my faith, antagonist questions shot at me like a BB gun. And I remember at one point, finally, one of the other professors, there was a couple that were kind of fence sitters, and one finally came forward and said, look, I think this is actually getting really mean. Let's, ask her about her teaching. But great, finally. They're asking me all of these questions. One professor got up and left. He said he was ashamed of what I had become. That sort of environment. And I remember when I left, I thought, I did not get that job. And I came home and I said to Kent, who had been bringing the baby in and out so I could nurse between things, I know I didn't get the job. And I just said to him, wow, it just really, really hurts also to have that kind of reaction from people I cared for. I do care for still. And Kent said, let's make up a bunch of bumper stickers that say mean people suck. And go stick them on the back of every bumper in the car parking lot at night when they're when
that,
we're there.
Is that where those came from?
He didn't hit the church. And I think it's wonderful that, as Chesterton said, that Satan fell because he took himself too seriously, the gravity of himself. I love that about thoughtful Christians taking our God seriously, but not ourselves so much so. And it was interesting because I did not get the job. But a few weeks later, the chair of the department asked me out for lunch. And I went with him. And he's actually a very sort of gentle man, somebody I've thought highly of for a long time. And he said to me, I wanted to apologize. First of all, I wanted to tell you, I didn't know what to do. It felt like I was watching a train wreck and I actually didn't know what to say or do. And he was a new chair. And these were more senior professors about him. But secondly, he said, please don't sue us. And he said, I'm also, he said, I appreciated your grace under that kind of pressure, which of course was not me. Again, it's Ephesians, isn't it? And he said, I grew up Catholic. I'm the youngest of seven, and I want to go back and give this some more thought. And another professor ended up contacting me about the same thing. Maybe two or three in the group eventually. But as I was leaving, after having lunch with him, he said to me, why did you do it? Why did you tell us then that you were publishing in these ways and speaking out in these ways? And I told him that I thought it was more important to share the truth than to get the job. I don't know where that sentence came from, too, because I am certainly not able to think of that off the top of my head. But the Lord uses all of us in amazing ways, and sometimes we have to weigh. It can be very painful to turn and, you know, brush the sand from our shoes from a place that we love and have gone back to. But I also remember really thinking about, I had meditated on one of my favorite stories from Luke chapter 8, where the man who's healed by demons. And I brought it to read because I love memorizing. I think memorizing is really important, but I didn't memorize the whole thing. So I love this story. I'm going to read from 26, verses 26 to 39. They sailed to the region of Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee, and when Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. And when he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the impure spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Think about how different that story is when we really think about it with metaphorical eyes, right? How it's all of us. Jesus asked him, I love this. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him, and they begged Jesus repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and the demons begged Jesus to let them go into the pigs, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. I used to think that was one of the creepiest stories when I first read the Bible. You know, Christians are wacko, but it makes more and more and more sense. We think about the demons we all have and we all carry. When those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out, sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return home and tell how much God has done for you." So the man went away and told all over town how much Jesus had done for him. And not only is that a personally really important and significant passage for me, having become a Christian elsewhere and then coming back to home, but I think it's important for all of us where we're at. And that oftentimes people meet Jesus with fear, and that fear comes from trauma. Sometimes the church has inflicted that trauma, which complicates the fear even more so, as I eventually found out a little bit more about this other professor. But how do we respond to that fear and to that trauma? We have to respond by love. They will know that we are disciples. We will know that we are followers of Christ by our love. And sometimes it's really, really hard, but that's also part of the privilege.
Is that, would you say that's the way we engage the academic world then, while at the same time not compromising biblical truth, is that love and
yeah, and being... Yes, I think so. I mean, it sounds like such a John Lennon answer, but and it can be really, really complicated. But I think, and I don't know the answer perfectly, because as I said, I know people who've done it successfully, navigated in various ways, and then I know people like myself who've just left because they know they can only deal with so many things and decided prayerfully how to best apply those energies, and might re-enter, might not. There's other people I know that are over manage that. There's a wonderful professor in California and writer called Mary Poplin, and she was a feminist and atheist, and very, very, she shares this very openly in her memoir, very anti-Jesus, spoke highly against it in the California academic school systems and things, and against faith, and had this very, very difficult life. It talks about sleeping with lots of people and drugs and all sorts of things, and she eventually becomes a Christian. She has a life-changing moment and becomes a Christian, and writes about then going and spending her sabbatical year serving with Mother Teresa. Mm. And she writes this beautiful book called Finding Calcutta. And she said, ultimately, it turns your whole world upside down. But when she went back to academia, she found herself, every time she went to go lecture, crying. These tears would come, and she couldn't lecture. Or she would end up talking about, trying to talk through them, until she realized with the spiritual director that, you know, tears can often be the Holy Spirit at work. There's a whole theology of tears. And she realized that there was a division in herself where she was trying to live a life as though she didn't know this Christ, but realizing among the academic world and the students in front of her and the other women and that she was speaking to needed her to be whole in that, not divided. And there's such a tendency in ourselves to divide ourselves like the demons against ourselves so that we can actually not bear witness to Christ because of our own fears. But when we're whole in him, we're actually very safe or saved. And so there's other academics out there like herself that are teaching and navigating that system. It's like anything else. I mean, I don't think it's different from anywhere else. The whole world is fallen and difficult, but academia poses those kind of special challenges in its vying for truth.
Yeah, which is bizarre when you think of it. They're pursuing mm-hmm. truth and yet ignoring it at the same time, and just becoming a niche.
Right.
For those here as believers, what are we losing if we neglect our mind? What do you think is the thing that we're losing the most?
Well, I don't think it's any small thing that the Lord asks us to love him with all of our hearts and minds and souls, and you know that we're asked to do that entirely. And yet I also think it's tremendously comforting that nowhere does Jesus praise our intellect in the Bible. There's nowhere where that's a requirement for faith. Nothing's a requirement for faith except faith, and faith surpasses all of those other things. And so in many ways, all of that doesn't matter. I think ultimately it comes down to how our hearts are before God. We answer for our hearts. He knows the name that he's going to write on the stone that he'll give to us. And how are we truthful in that, in our own hearts before God? And if intellectual pursuits are one of your strengths and one of your gifts, and you know that in your heart of hearts, then how can you use that perhaps to glorify him? But if you have downs and that, or you have any other issues, I mean, does that preclude you from the gospel of grace? No. I mean, I think that it's just tremendously freeing that there's no place in which the intellect per se, if anything, were shown through the Pharisees and whatnot, that it can be a trap we have to be careful of, another source of pride. It gave me tremendous freedom and relief to understand grace. But I think separate from that, we have to keep in mind, John, and this is what I always struggle with my students and with myself too, but that really important distinction between information and wisdom. Hmm. Because the Bible is a proponent of wisdom. We bombard people with information all the time, but we don't give them wisdom. I mean, we see that in the sex education, you know, debate happening and stuff, giving people all this kind of information and facts. But, you know, the definition of wisdom is knowing when to use information, or as Genesis shows us, knowing when not to. And the Bible helps us build hearts of discernment, minds of discernment, cultivate what I like to term with my students as spiritual thinking. You know, Jesus speaks to us in parables because metaphor in many ways is more powerful than literal. And yet the literal reality is also very much there too. There's the actual suffering on the cross. And it's the intersection, I think, of those things that the practice of disciplining our minds to try and be present to God instead of hiding from him. is really at the basis of the wisdom.
Wow, amen. Now we've come to the end of our time. Is there one thing you want to leave everybody with? Because that was a really good nugget that you just, I have to admit,
no,
that was a really...
I struggle with it. I think I still have such a heart for students, because maybe that's the age that I became a Christian, and but with all of us, and with how students often say to me, well, what is the relevance of the Bible? You know, I have these hormones raging through my body, so why should I wait to have sex? Or I don't see God. Even my one twin asks me this all the time. I have the one little theological twin who's always like a mini pastor, like his grandpa. And then I have the other twin who asks all the questions that I do. And I'll tuck him in and he'll be like, Mom, why can't we see God? Is he really there? Can't see him. I prayed to win my baseball game and I didn't. And I think, oh, you're so like me. It's so annoying. And I think it would be to say that reverence is relevant. Reverence is relevant. We're told that wisdom begins with the fear of God. And I think there's a knee-jerk reaction to think we have to be afraid of this fearful God. And God is all-powerful and almighty, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. But that there's also this awesomeness, this wonder, this way in which he can't be contained. And when we live our lives reverent of that, it's always relevant to the decisions we're making. And that's our greatest human dignity.
Carolyn, I want to thank you very much for being here this morning. That was awesome. Thank you very much. Absolutely. I'm gonna pray for Carolyn as the worship team probably comes up and gets ready for closing us off this morning. I hope you were really blessed by this, because it's really good to hear from someone who's actually in the trenches and experienced this firsthand. For many of us, they're very pertinent questions and very real questions. So let's pray together. Father, thank you for this morning and just the way that our lives and our hearts have been touched. Thank you for Carolyn and her wisdom and her willingness to be here this morning to speak about her life and her experiences. And Lord, I know for many of us, it's hit areas of our lives that it was good to be encouraged in this way. So Lord, as we close this service with this final song, we want to pray your blessing upon Carolyn and upon us as well, as we continue to serve you in whatever capacity you have given us, in whatever gifts you have endowed us with. We thank you in all faithfulness to you, for you are the great and mighty God. Thank you for Jesus, for the salvation that is ours through him, and the life that it brings us to, and the fear of the Lord, and the reverence that we have when we walk in oneness with you. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.